its current state on 90.5 WKAR. The MSU Symphony Orchestra's next concert is Friday night at Wharton Center. It features the fourth and last symphony of Brahms and Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring. And current state's Melissa Benmark is here to tell us more. Hi, Melissa.
Hey there, Mark Bayshore. Had a nice talk with Kevin Noe recently about the program, and I had assumed going into this that the Appalachian Spring version would be the full orchestrated form, and they're actually going to be performing the original small orchestra piece. So I talked to Kevin Noe about how that was different from the more probably more often performed orchestral work.
Believe it or not, I have never done the big symphony orchestra version. I know the little one, the 13-instrument one, quite well. I've done that two or three times. And I think it brings a level of intimacy and a special kind of communicative quality that I think is rare in any work, regardless of the size of the piece. I think in many ways that's one of the most extraordinary American offerings that we have. I don't know what more a person could ask from a piece of music than Appalachian Spring gives you.
I wonder sometimes, looking at the story of it, he knew he was writing a ballet for Martha Graham, and people have said, oh, you so convey the sense of the Appalachian Mountains and everything, and it doesn't sound like he necessarily was looking at doing that. I wonder if the fact that how it was being conceived has meant that whoever hears it kind of assigns their own images to it.
Well, I think that's always that way in music, right? I mean, Stravinsky always said that music is in and of itself its own kind of emotional and artistic form, and any other kind of linking that we do where it reminds us of something else, that's all good and well, but that's entirely our own doing that we thrust that on it. So I suppose that's true, but there is something so immediately, deeply American about Appalachian Spring in particular. This is true of all of Copland's music. I just did Billy the Kid a couple weeks ago, and it certainly has that flavor to it, but it does have a little bit more of a caricature of the Old West quality. Appalachian Spring has something that's so profoundly American that I find myself constantly struggling with the right words to articulate why. It seems so me. You know, and I know I'm not alone. I mean, many people hear that piece and they feel that they immediately understand it. I mean, whatever understanding music is, I don't know that I understand any of it, you know what I mean? But Appalachian Spring certainly comes the closest to feeling like it was written as a part of me somehow, of maybe any piece I've ever been around.
What part of the piece do you find the most intriguing?
Well, actually, in this particular case, it's the process. I mean, this is a very unique project for us. It's only 13 players, and this was a volunteer group and by audition only. And the group is doing something quite extraordinary. They're playing the entire piece from memory, and we're rehearsing from memory. And the group is only rehearsing with scores. They only bring the full score of the whole piece to rehearsal, so everybody's aware of what everybody else has. And we rehearse that way now, and we're close. I mean, we've got it, the whole thing from memory, and people are standing while they play. People can move. If people have a duet, the violin and the flute have a little duet. They can walk and stand right next to each other while they play it. People are moving all over the place and communicating, and there are no stands involved, so there's no block between one person and the next. All the visual contact is eye to eye, or maybe in this case, heart to heart, you know. And I think it has brought something so extraordinary, I don't know how to describe it. I mean, it's been one of the most joyous rehearsal processes I've ever been a part of, and I'm extremely proud of these musicians for putting in the extra time to make this an extraordinary thing. And we're planning on doing it here on this February 7th show. We're working on, hopefully, the possibility of doing it again on a March 24th show at Fairchild Theater, which would be a crossover show, which would be half Appalachian Spring and half jazz students improvising in part on themes of Appalachian Spring. And we're going to record this soon in Fairchild as well, so we have a memento of this time in our lives when we chose to carve out that much time and really dig into it. And I'm just thrilled to be a part of it. I think anybody who's ever heard a group play from memory after they've put that kind of care into it. It's exceedingly rare, and I think you can hear something special. I do a lot of works from memory. About the only pieces I ever conduct with the score are concertos for complex reasons. So that's not unusual for me. But to have the whole group learn the whole piece from memory, that's a very different kind of thing. Now, you're accustomed to hearing a concerto soloist, you know, would very often play from memory. But many people that I've talked to that are doing the Appalachian Spring, who have, of course, also played concertos from memory, say that it's actually much easier to memorize something like that because you're always playing the subject. You're always playing the main thing, and you don't have these rests, and then you just play a few little notes that are just a part of a decoration of somebody else's thing. Everything has this wonderful front and center quality to it. And when you're playing background and you're just playing the same note for 8 bars and then 2 bars of rest and then, you know, a little something or other, that's tricky. You know, that's tricky because it comes up differently each time, and Copland's particularly crafty about keeping us on our feet and changing little things, so it's hard to remember. But in many ways, the payoff, I would say, it doesn't come from a concerto soloist playing from memory. They could play with the score, and I'm not sure it would change the things that much. But when you have 13 people all communicating with each other and they're all playing from memory and every little nuance counts back and forth, anyway, it's a marvelous project.
The Brahms Symphony No. 4, his last symphony, a guy that didn't even think he was capable of writing the symphony. Talk about the experience of conducting that.
Well, it's my first time with Brahms 4. Obviously, it's one of those pieces that people know. You know, you hear it done a lot for a good reason, but it's my first time studying it. I feel like I'm really close to 2 and 3, and this is my first time with 4. It feels quite different to me. It feels like a different sort of animal. This one is very sort of tightly crafted. You know, I find in 2 and 3, Brahms is more prone to wander off in Fantasia land for a few bars and then come back. Whereas in this particular case, I think he's tried to ratchet it down from a compositional standpoint so that everything relates to everything else and it keeps the form and the kind of intensity really taut. So the impact of the thing has this very dense, that's the word, a very dense kind of impact, you know, in the way that, for example, a piece like Daphnis and Chloe that I'm going to do in a couple weeks doesn't have that density. I mean, it's equally wonderful, but there are more perforations in the sound. Do you know what I mean? So something about that density I think is really interesting, and I don't know that he could have done that route any better than he did, you know. I mean, he explored every possible way of mining a very small amount of material and extracting from it a whole piece, and I think, obviously, he did a great job.
Well, Kevin Noe, thanks for talking to us about the music, and good luck with the concert.
Always a pleasure talking with you.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.